Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. It's a really common thing when you're a teenager to get just completely fed up with everything, with your parents, your school, and sometimes even your friends. And for a moment, all you know is you just want to get out. Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. Bea Orsini is my guest today, and Bea had, well, every reason to feel that way. She's 22 now, and she's got this really great job that she loves and she believes in. Bea works for the Salvation Army's Oasis Youth Support Network as their school's liaison officer. That means she talks to students and she helps young people who are experiencing homelessness in their lives and just talks from her own experience. I'm happy she can do that today. Hello, Bea.
Hi, Richard.
What do you love about your job at the moment?
Well, for one, I guess it's an absolute privilege as Oasis School's liaison to be able to speak to students about what I consider to be a really important issue. I get to engage them about the issue of youth homelessness in Australia, and for me, being homeless myself about 2 years ago, it's an absolute honour to be able to go and speak to them from personal experience, and also just to maybe try and be a role model for students as well, and also to try and encourage young people that maybe haven't been in that situation to even, you know, try and look out for their peers and, you know, become advocates for them.
Can I tell you what really, I saw you in video giving a speech, and yeah. What really freaked me out is you're so articulate and, you know, and so together. You seem to be so together at the moment anyway. And I thought, how is it that, you know, someone who's got their head so clearly in the right space now, how you became homeless or a couple of years ago, I suppose it shows you the great distance you can traverse in such a short distance of time. Do people look at you then as someone, well, I can do what she did?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm really hoping for. I mean, when I became homeless, it was kind of quite a surreal thing for me to go through. I guess at the time, like at first I thought, oh, geez, this is just bad timing. Or at the time I actually wasn't even quite sure that I was homeless. And then ironically enough as well, when I was living at a crisis refuge after it had happened, I managed to get myself a job working as a team leader at a law firm while I was homeless. And, I mean, obviously it's quite a complex story as to how everything fell into place like that, but it just made me learn that homelessness doesn't actually discriminate anyone at all, and that's actually really scary.
Yeah, that's the scary bit about it, isn't it? Tell me about what Oasis does now, the kind of work they do, and you know, part of that work is you're that part of it, but largely what they do for homeless people.
Sure. Well, I guess I can speak from my personal experience being a client of Oasis. When I actually walked through there, it was a friend that told me to go. I was couch surfing on her couch at the time, and she'd been homeless herself, and she said to me, look, this is actually my first, you know, independent housing that I've been able to get since being homeless. I really am worried about jeopardizing that having you here. You need to go to Oasis. And that was the first I'd ever heard of it, and I thought, what's Oasis, honestly? Like, if my family isn't capable of looking after me, if my, you know, friends aren't capable of looking after me either, what's a place like this Oasis going to do for me? And so when I walked in, I was actually feeling quite, you know, sort of cynical about it, or, you know, maybe the pride that I was hanging on to.
Were you expecting it to be this kind of like a Dickensian workhouse or something, a grey and bleak sort of place, like, you know, get in there and start making rope or something like that?
Well,
is that what you were expecting?
Not quite. I did, when I sort of imagined it in my head, I was like, you know, it's going to feel like a hospital, maybe like a mental institution or what I'd imagine that to be. And I was like, oh, geez, like, how am I going to tell people that I'm even going here? There were all these sorts of just negative thoughts running through my head. But she said that she'd go with me, and that was enough. That the fact that she was willing to come with me, I thought that was really sweet of her. And so I said, all right, you know, I'm not going to put any more strain on you. I walked in there, and the first thing I noticed, obviously having the hospital sort of thing in my head, was that I walked in there and just warm colours on the walls and just this open space. So that was the first thing that drew me in. I was like, all right, I'm already wrong, and I've only just set foot in the door, and that's it. And so when I got there, the first person that I actually saw was, his name's John Harris, and he's actually my boss now. So he's the youth liaison officer for the Eastern Territory. He's the very first person, and I actually, just to sum him up, he's like the Steve Irwin of youth homelessness. He's like the most enthusiastic guy you'll ever meet. I'm pretty sure I walked in and he was like, g'day. And I was so shy that, you know, at that time I had like the lowest self-esteem ever, I think. And I could barely look at people in the eye, and I thought, what's this guy? He's not this, you know, mental institution sort of ward officer, like,
no,
about
he was
to
the
take
Steve
me
Irwin
to
of homelessness.
Yeah, and so they actually took the time to sit down with me and just hear a bit of my story. Obviously, they wanted to know how I'd ended up being on Oasis's doorstep, and I was actually, yeah.
I was just going to say, I once talked to a psychologist who said that teenagers will often don't gravitate towards the source of the greatest love, they gravitate towards the source of the greatest acceptance. So it sounded like you felt like you were being accepted there. Is that what it is?
I think you've actually spot on there. I mean, I had two youth workers, literally, I didn't even have to wait. They just said, come in and sit down with us and just tell us your story. We want to hear what's going on in your life. And that, to me, was really something that was quite valuable. And so I did exactly that. And
when you did that, when you told your story, had you really reflected much on it as a whole, or were you kind of just living in the moment? And was it the first time you'd ever kind of taken a step back to see it in its entirety once you'd sat down and spoken to their being?
I think that happened a bit later. It was actually at the point when I was living in the crisis refuge, and I hadn't been able to find employment yet, that I was actually sort of, I had a lot of time to reflect on my story. And to get into the crisis refuge, I had to tell my story again as well. So twice over, you start to really go back and think about things. And obviously they're looking for specifics as to what's gotten you to that point. So I think as a youth worker, there's certain things that they're looking for to try and figure out the best, you know, sort of environment to place you in. I don't think when I got there, Oasis would have had a bed available for me anyway. They only have 13 beds there. But regardless, they knew that I didn't have any sort of serious drug and alcohol issues, and I think the sort of girl that I was back then, barely able to speak to people and just a bit of a wreck, to be honest, I don't think they thought I could quite handle the environment there. And so they really listened to those needs that you have, and they ended up securing me accommodation in a women's refuge, where I could have my own bed in my own room. And so just the fact that they didn't say, oh, all right, we'll just chuck her wherever there's somewhere available, which, I mean, wouldn't surprise me seeing as beds are so scarce anyway, but they were able to actually give me some options that
But you grew up in, you grew up in Canberra with your mum. Why wasn't your dad around?
Well, I guess we have to go right back to before I was born, because I have never really actually met him to my knowledge, unless it was when I was... Well, he was around for a bit after I was born, and then he took off. But basically, from my understanding, what I believed happened with my parents was that my mum grew up in Manila in the Philippines, and my dad was Italian, and he was basically looking for a woman to marry. I was told that he was looking for someone on the internet, but after an interview, a radio interview that I did a while back, my mum actually called me and said that that wasn't the case, yet it's what she'd told me a while back. So I'm not too sure what's happened there.
All right, so they'd had this long-distance contact.
Somehow. And
gotten married?
Yes. From what I understand, just from the stories that my mum's told me, she had a hard life in Manila, and she basically wanted to, you know, escape and start a new life. So he promised her a better life in Australia where he would support her here. And I believe that he was about 20 years her senior. So that happened and they moved here. And from what I believe, everything was fine for a while until she fell pregnant with me. And that was basically never part of my father's plan to, you know, have this wife and move to a new country with her. And the words out of my mum's mouth basically were that I was a mistake. And so when that happened, from my understanding, I'm not entirely sure when, how old I was, but I knew that he took off pretty early on. And he left my mum in Canberra, I believe, completely. She didn't have anywhere to live. She couldn't, I think she could speak English okay, but not very fluently. And she had a newborn baby. So that was how what I was born into, basically.
So where did she go to live? Where did she find a place to live?
I've asked her about it, and I think the details are quite hard for us to sort of converse and, you know, set in very solid point form. But I understand that St. Vincent de Paul actually took my mum and I in, and we lived there for a while until they set us up with government housing.
So you lived then in a housing commission flat, essentially, in
Canberra? Yeah, for most of my childhood until I was about 16 years old, I think.
Bea Orsini is my guest in conversation today. Bea is the youth liaison support, sorry, I'll say that again, Oasis Youth Support Network's school liaison officer. She talks to students and helps young people and gets them to understand the issues of homelessness amongst young people. You were an anxious little girl, weren't you, Bea, by the sound of things? Your mum had to stay with you every night until you fell asleep?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I honestly, my memories of my childhood are really quite hazy, but I definitely recall that I was really, really afraid of many, many things. Things that someone in primary school shouldn't even quite be aware of. Specifically to do with the dark, I think I was just basically afraid of the dark itself, which isn't uncommon for a lot of kids to feel that way. However, my mum would stay by my side until I fell asleep. And I think that although she was trying to help me, you know, to try and protect me, I think that she actually made it worse because I really believe that she was protecting me, guarding me from something scary. And so the second that she left, I was completely unsafe again. And it sort of went further than that. It went beyond the dark. I was an only child and I don't think I had many toys at all. In fact, I recall maybe having just one toy, a secondhand teddy. And so I had to keep myself quite entertained, but the fears sort of mutilated in my mind, I guess you could call it. And I became scared of things like diseases in primary school. So brain tumours, getting cancer, getting diabetes, getting epilepsy, meningococcal. Those are my earliest childhood memories, just sitting there trying to talk myself out of the fact that I wouldn't get them. Or
you poor little kid, worried about diabetes in primary school.
Yeah.
So you're really anxious little kid. You know, did you conclude from that that you were troubled or because really what I'm hearing is kind of the flip side, the flip side of what would otherwise be a really imaginative and sensitive little girl, really. I mean, that's the downside of that, really. But there's this great upside to it. Did you ever see that in yourself?
Well, at the time, on one hand, I never had anyone really to tell me that it was, you know, okay, or that, you know, I didn't have to worry about stuff like that. I do recall going to the doctor with my mum once about it, and the doctor said, you really, really need to take her to see a psychologist. Obviously, a psychologist was too much money, so my mum never took me. So on one hand, it was quite a dark place. But on the other hand, I kind of just lived with it at the same time. I had no one to tell me that it was okay, but I had no one to tell me that it was strange or the wrong thing either. So I kind of just lived with it, not really questioning whether other children think about it or not. I just thought that was a normal thing to worry about. And I dealt with it in quite unique ways. In order to deal with, you know, issues such as worrying about diabetes and stuff when you're in primary school and you don't have very many toys, you start to come up with some really creative ways to entertain yourself. And I definitely did that.
How? Tell me how you entertained yourself.
Well, most of my childhood, what I remember and how I played in playtime, I remember because we lived in government flats, we didn't have a backyard or anything, and my mum wouldn't let me go outside. I don't have any memories of playing in parks that often or anything like that. However, what I do remember is getting newspaper articles, you know, the real estate section where they show you the plans of a house.
So you'll
The floor plan. That's exactly right. So in Canberra, they have this newspaper and it shows you all the floor plans of every single house that's available to buy or rent. And so what I'd do is I'd spread them out on the living room floor and I'd had these little beads, so beads that you use to make like a bracelet or something. And I would actually, the beads would become little families and they would live in the floor plans of these houses, which actually became a little community. And so I'd be like this real estate agent that would walk families through the house, these little beads. But once I built the community up, I had no desire to actually play with them using my imagination. It was all about this really complex construction of communities and families and homes. So I would sort of wreck the village and start all over again. And that's all I did, just over and over again, build these. They even had like little roads and were separated into streets.
You can see where this is coming from now, can't you? I mean,
yeah.
You are with your mum who's, by the sound of things, is quite an anxious person herself. And you're not going outside and you don't have anything but your mum really. And there you are making little families on the floor plans of the real estate page, B.
Yeah.
Do you think you were longing for a kind of a quote-unquote normal family?
Well, I mean, I've been seeing a psychologist recently and I've told him this story and he basically explained to me that just in textbook terms that generally when children play with houses or they create houses when they're younger or their playtime revolves around that in any way, they're generally longing for some sort of like stability in their in their lives or normality. And the fact that I was playing with, I don't know if it has anything to do with it, but just in my mind, the first thing I thought was, well, I played with a whole village of houses, streets of houses, and the families always had two parents and more than one child. So I don't know if there's something in that. It's just become quite interesting to think of. I mean, you can sort of look at it and say, oh, my gosh, that's a bit sad, you know, a small child.
Well, that's what kids do, though.
That's
what kids do. I mean, kids do that. It's just it's so poetic in a way that you do it with beads on a floor plan. How about your mum? Was she working at the time? Was she able to work?
At the time, and once again, honestly, my childhood is such a distant blur to me. However, what I do remember of my mum is I don't believe she was working at the time. I believe that she was getting Centrelink payments, and so she was at home quite a lot. And how I know that is because I do remember her sleeping all the time to the point where, you know, I'd try to wake her up to play with her because, you know, I just wanted to play with someone. And she wouldn't always wake up. And sometimes I'd be checking her pulse or putting my hand on her stomach to see if she was breathing because I wasn't always sure. For that, it was a lot for me to try and cope, I guess. And building the houses, I think, were my coping mechanism. But now my mum can speak English really fluently and she is actually working at a nursing home. I believe she got that job at the nursing home when I was either in year 10 or year 11 and she's been working in that field ever since. So.
I mean, I'm not a doctor, but it wouldn't be... I mean, it's not hard to see in some ways. I mean, there's your mum. She's come from a really gregarious but poor society in the Philippines. And there she is in Canberra, which is, you know, I lived in Canberra. I know Canberra, you know, love Canberra, but it's people keep to themselves very, very, there's not a huge community spirit there. She doesn't have much English. It's cold and she's got no husband and it's no wonder it would be surprising if she hadn't become depressed, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Well, exactly. And when I was younger, I didn't understand it at all. I didn't understand why she was sleeping all the time. And now that I'm older and I look back on it, I think for her to actually be working full time now is actually really amazing. But yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all that she was depressed. It doesn't surprise me that she wanted to sleep all the time because she didn't have any friends. She also left her family of six sisters and one brother, I believe, in Manila. And just to come here and have your husband leave you, oh my gosh, like it's a fairy tale gone wrong, really.
Yeah. What was the precious thing of yours that she took to cash converters because you were short of cash?
Yeah. I mean, I don't blame her. Times were pretty desperate. I remember having a fight with her one time and knocking a plate of toast that she was about to eat out of her hands and onto the floor and just thinking, oh, my gosh, I shouldn't have done that. It actually would have been better if I'd hit her or something because, like, she really needed to eat the toast. So times were tough, but she had on VCR, so not DVD because we're talking old school times. I was pretty young, a video of The Lion King, and I really, really loved it. And I remember her taking it to cash converters to try and trade it in for some money. I think I also recall her taking in a hairdryer at the same time, which she'd already bought from cash converters. So I don't think they gave her any money for that, but I think they gave her a few dollars for the Lion King video, which, you know, the sentimental value didn't really equal up to the couple of dollars. But I think looking back on it, maybe it did. I don't know what she spent that money on. But, yeah, that's just something I remember, which is just quite upsetting to me. My partner today actually downloaded The Lion King for me, you know, as a sort of like, here you go, like, you can watch it now on, you know, like our plasma TV and it's all great, but I don't want to watch it. Like, I'm actually too scared.
You needed it back then.
Yeah. Like I have some sort of emotional attachment to it, meaning that I can't watch it, but one day I'll watch it.
Was your mum a bit overprotective of you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, once again, not too hard to imagine if I'm the only sort of thing that she had left. You know, she didn't have a job, her family, her husband, but she did have a little baby, which is all well and fine when you're a baby, a toddler, or even in preschool and primary school. However, when you hit high school, it's pretty much the worst thing imaginable for a teenager to have a mother that was as overprotective as she was.
In what way? How was she? Was she demonstrably overprotective in front of your friends? What did she do? What would she do that would embarrass you?
Looking back on it, I actually feel quite special because it's nice that, you know, my mum's really my only family, and the fact that she loved me that much, she when I wanted to go to the movies with my friends, she would sort of stand there right by my side until my friend had arrived, and then she'd have to walk us into the cinemas and actually watch me until I went in and was seated. And then so she would know that I had actually gone in there and I didn't run off anywhere else. And then when I walked out of the cinema, oh, she'd be there.
So what were your friends like? Were they going, oh, B, your mum's here, it's so embarrassing. Were they like that?
Well, I think I actually beat them to it, as teenagers do. So I'd be like, oh, like, it's just so embarrassing. And they'd be like, yeah, it is. But I just had to get in there first. So I think I was actually quite a little brat back then. I'm not proud of it. But, yeah, I mean, and also I wasn't allowed to go to sleepovers until some shocking age. And it did put a lot of peer pressure on me to, you know, sort of try and conform to normal things.
But how was your mum managing to pay for things like, you know, uniforms and school camps?
Well, I actually, you know, didn't realise that there was anything wrong with our situation at all until I became a teenager and started going around to sleepovers and comparing my house to my friends' houses. Because I actually went to preschool, primary school and high school just fine. I went to, you know, perfectly good public schools with children that, you know, had come from all walks of life. Being Canberra, you've got a lot of ambassadors' children. So, you know, I felt very normal, I guess you could say. However, there were sort of alarm bells that when I went on year six school camp, my mum had actually called me and said that I haven't been able to pay for the bills for, you know, however long because I've had to send you on school camp. I think that she was actually just calling to make sure that I'd gotten there safe. And then all of this stuff came out about how much of a sacrifice she'd made for me to be on the camp because she couldn't afford to pay for anything else. And that actually really broke my heart. So I didn't want to be on the camp at all anymore. And, but really to answer your question, I think, unfortunately, I don't know who, but someone decided it would be a good idea to give her a credit card. And so that's how a lot of things were actually paid for. And so, yeah, and then plus her Centrelink payments and stuff like that. So
did kids give you a hard time about living in a government flat, or were they nice about it?
Well, I do remember in year seven, so first year of high school, you know, there's already a lot of pressure on you because there's the big scary kids around. And I was in my year seven Italian class, if I remember correctly, and everyone was talking about where they lived, you know, because we're all new and we want to get to know each other and see where everyone, you know, comes from. And so they're all talking about their big, beautiful houses. And I actually explained where I lived to the people that were in the class. And they all, once they'd figured it out, they were like, oh, wait a second. You live in the ugly brown flats. You live in the ugly brown flats. And I lived in really quite a...
Sorry, did they put it to you like that? You live in the ugly brown flats? Is that what they said?
I'm not even joking. That is word for word what they said.
Thanks for that. That's nice, isn't it?
And I thought, oh. And in primary school, up until year six, my mum walked me to and from where we were living to the primary school. And I think after that happened, the ugly brown flats thing, I begged her not to walk me to and from school anymore. And the reason why wasn't just because I was a teenager and sort of growing up. It was because I was so embarrassed by that comment that I felt it was necessary from year seven until the day I dropped out of college halfway through year 12 to run to and from my flats to the school and back again on the way home until I felt that I was a safe enough distance that people wouldn't associate me with the flats. And yeah, it basically, looking back on it, I'm like, I probably drew a hell of a lot more attention to myself bolting from the flat.
There's that bee running again. Yeah. She must be in training. Yes.
And my friend's parents, once I got a bit older and, you know, I was, you know, staying at their houses, they would have to drop me at the shopping sort of district and I would walk to my house. And for a parent, that's quite alarming. You know, they want to drop their child's friend at their house, but they would do it because I was so adamant, even though they knew exactly where I lived, and I'm pretty sure they'd remain parked until they could see me walk back in. But it was this whole, you know, no one ever said a word. They just knew that I needed to not be associated with it. So
things went great between you and your mum after a while too as a teenager. How did that, what happened there? Did you, how did arguments start to develop between you and your mum? Was it an argument or was some other thing?
Yeah, I think unfortunately for us, we went from not talking much at all, you know, when she was sort of sleeping a lot when I was younger, to me hitting a certain age where I challenged her in every single way possible. So my friends would say, oh, how come your mum doesn't drive, or where's your car, or, and you know, just sort of innocent little questions like that. Or I'd go to their houses and realize that they have, you know, this amazing big fridge, or they have these beautiful decorated rooms, and I would go back to my mum and say, well, why do we not have any of that? And it didn't take long for every single conversation from high onwards to just turn into screaming battle matches, because I just resented her so much at the time when I was about 16, and she just couldn't handle it.
Yeah, that's really common though. You know, that's really common for teenagers. Why isn't our house like the house of someone who's slightly rich? Like my friend's parents who are slightly richer than us. That's really quite common. Were you still suffering from anxiety as a teenager, or did that even get worse?
Because I was distracted by, you know, the high school life and stuff like that, I'd say it lessened a bit. However, it was still there in every aspect of my life, where you could still ask my friends today and say, oh, what does B think about diabetes? And they'd all, like, roll their eyes because they'd be like, oh, my gosh, we didn't hear the end of it. They had to constantly reassure me that I wouldn't get diabetes. And stuff like that. But I was quite distracted by rebelling against my mum, I guess you could say. And for someone that was so anxious and so worried about diseases and stuff, I sure was a reckless 16-year-old that partied a hell of a lot. So.
Well, yeah, that's my next question. I was a teenager in Canberra. I mean, that's sort of, that sounds like a movie, doesn't it? I was a teenager in Canberra. But I remember that, and that's a little bit older than you'd be, and hard as that may be to believe. But in that time, I mean, there's this really great, vibrant cultural scene amongst young people in Canberra, but huge parts of it were kind of destroyed by, you know, heroin that came into Canberra at that time, and a lot of guys just kind of got lost in dope smoking as well. Was that around you, and did you indulge in that yourself?
Well, not heroin to my knowledge, that I'm hoping it was never around me. However, you know, in Canberra, you're exactly right. My friends, like when we got into high school, it was quite a popular thing for their parents to actually go away for the weekend. So, you know, to Batemans Bay or Maroombula or wherever it was. And they would leave the house to the child. So there would be house parties around every corner happening. You could take your pick. And that's a pretty common thing for a teenager, which was really sort of just a part of growing up. However, I seemed to take it one step further, and that didn't seem to prove as enough of an escape for me from what was going on in my home life. So I ended up actually at the age of 16, you know, partying underage in clubs in the city, and I ended up, while my friends were all at home and in bed at this point, I didn't want to go home. So I'd end up hanging out with people, you know, 10, 15 years older than me, in basically the, you know, hard dance scene of Canberra, and very much started to quickly throw my weekends away taking ecstasy and speed and stuff, which automatically put a barrier up between my high school friends and me. They didn't understand what was going on, or, you know, they just thought, oh my gosh, she's becoming this drug addict.
Was there part of you that liked that mystique? You know, because you then suddenly became a kind of more interesting and dangerous figure in their eyes, I suppose. Was there part of you that kind of liked that?
Well, the fact that I was still able to retain my friendship with them, they didn't say, you know, we don't want anything to do with you. I think definitely I was able to live this sort of double life, if you will. And it also just provided me a very, I don't quite know how to describe it, but basically it just gave me something else to focus on in a weird way. So it allowed me to just become this totally different person that just was so out of control yet in control at the same time of this, like, insane life that she lived. And I did enjoy being dangerous and reckless, because it sort of distracted me from being at home, because it's almost like when drama unfolded, you know, in the city, or like fights are about to happen or something, I almost like that, because it was seemed so much more important than arguing with my mum, that it took away from the pain that I was really feeling and let me sort of be a part of something.
Yeah. I completely know what you're talking about, actually. You kind of like drama at that point, don't you?
Oh, definitely.
It makes your life seem larger than it may otherwise be. You were keeping a diary at that time, and you've only recently rediscovered it, and I'm looking at you with an open book in front of you. That's your diary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually been living in a box behind another box with all these clothes chucked in front of it for however many years. It's actually a diary that I wrote when I was 16, from August to December of 2004. And when I opened it, I knew that I'd written it, and I knew to a very, very, as I said, hazy extent of what was in there. When I opened it, I seriously almost threw up because I am so far from this person that I was back when I was 16 that I just can't even believe that I've written some of this stuff. But at the same time, I'm so glad that I kept it because it's almost like piecing the puzzle pieces of your life back together. You start to understand why you maybe think the way you do, why your views are the way you are. I mean, I know to this day that how much I care about youth homelessness and ending it. I've never questioned that, but it's almost when you look at stuff like this and you start to really understand why you care just so much about it.
Is there anything in there that you can read from today that you can share with the group, so to speak, that you feel you're okay about reading from in that diary?
Yeah, I mean, I used to write a lot of poetry, and as a bit
of course you did.
Yeah, of course, I did.
You can make those allowances, you know, that it's that kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm going to feel a bit embarrassed right now, but I think it's actually quite symbolic of the time that I'm okay with reading it. I was going to read another entry out about self-harm, which I was doing quite a lot at the time because I think that it's important to get it out there. So I'm not sure which one you'd prefer, the poetry
Whatever you think reveals a bit about yourself, because I've not looked at this. And so whatever you think reveals just a little bit, you don't have to read much, just a little bit that reveals something about you from that time when your head wasn't quite in the kind of good space that you are in today.
I'll read you the poem just because it's like just really gets it out there. The way I was feeling at the time, as a bit apprehensive as I am about it, just because I'm quite a happy-go-lucky person these days, and to look back on it, I'm like, oh, it just makes me feel a bit sick, actually. But I think it's important. So I wrote this on the 23rd of August in 2004, and it says, trailing behind my wings, slowly losing feathers as they fall, I have almost no strength left at all. I could be reached and send my soul wandering, but the future is young. I feel I'm growing old. To be heard would leave me searching for something to say. I have adjusted to being overlooked. I am my own shadow. There is a fever infecting us all, decaying through even its very own system. A fear not yet identified pounds me until I'm too afraid. You say you're too sick and too scared to carry me. Left uncertain I am. I see I brought it upon myself. And the chance to give it all back is too far away now. I am all to blame.
That begins a really powerful image for a bit of poetry, trailing feathers from your wings there. I mean, so much of that you can sort of see is that I think, you know, when we're teenagers, one of the reasons why we get gloomy is because we're kind of mourning our childhood in some ways, because you're not a child anymore. The child in you sort of, you're saying goodbye to that forever. And I can sort of really, I think I can hear that in that poem anyway.
Yeah.
And about how you can't see what the future is, but all you know is what you're leaving behind
you. That's right. Except, I don't know, I almost like when I look back on my childhood now, I don't feel particularly happy about it. So it's almost like I can't look back on it and think, oh, what I'd give to be a child again, because being a child for me was really complex. Like, I was worrying about financial security in primary school, and so it's almost like I'm not this child anymore, yet teenage years don't look great either. What on earth is going to come of me becoming an adult? Like, I think looking at that, it's just this real fear.
So you said you were self-harming. What form did that take?
Well, basically, when I hit about 16, I started really fighting with my mum. It was probably a bit of an attention thing, but I think it was also the guilt. Like, I knew what she was going through, and it's almost like I had this conscience when I was, you know, demanding stuff from her, yet the peer pressure overrode that. So it's like I did have a conscience about it, but I went ahead and did it anyway. And I think that I felt so guilty that I would sort of, you know, take like a what was it at the time, like a scalpel to my wrist, or I know that in Canberra, maybe going back to what you said about a heavy percentage of heroin users, you could actually go to these places and you could get like syringes for free, and you wouldn't, like, you could just walk in there and get them. Yet I wouldn't use it as a syringe. I think you could get the safe body piercing stuff as well, very sharp, and so that's what I would use to harm my wrist also.
Did that give you any relief at the time? Did you feel better after you'd done it, or just sick at the end of that?
I think just like writing in my diary.
Sorry, the reason why I'm asking is because I think it's good, as you say, to understand what's really going on with that process.
That's
I'm not trying to be ghoulish with this.
Of course. I think it's so important to get it out there still today. Like, I'm not sure what the percentage is. I'm sure it happens so much, yet people still don't want to talk about that kind of thing. Just like writing in my diary, it was very much a relief thing for me, a bit of an escape, just the same as being reckless and going out with people that I didn't know. It was just anything that I could do to just try and, like, I don't really know.
When you saw a counsellor, you saw a counsellor at school, what did the counsellor say to you?
Oh, she goes, I was recommended to see a counsellor at school. One of my teachers recommended to her that she see me. And so I got there and I sit down and she looks at me and she goes, oh, okay, you're left-handed, aren't you? And I go, how does she know that? Is she like some like genius that can like read my mind? And she's like, no, you've got cuts all over your right wrist and that's how I know you're left-handed. And I was like, okay, so that started my relationship with the counsellor. And so it's a bit surreal, really. Like, that was a real, like, almost like a slap in the face, because I was like, oh, everyone is noticing, and it didn't make me feel good at all.
What advice did you get?
She was really lovely. However, I was failing every single class except for drama. And so I was set to not graduate from year 12. And she basically said, look, you're getting really high results in a test for depression and anxiety. I will pass you in all of your classes so you can graduate from year 12. And I thought, ooh, like, graduate under false pretenses because someone felt sorry for me.
I don't deserve it.
Or, like, that is just why, like, yeah, and so I thought it would be better for me to leave. I didn't want someone to give me that opportunity.
Bea Orsini is my guest today, if you've just joined us in conversation. Bea now has this wonderful job that she absolutely loves for the Salvation Army's Oasis Youth Support Network. She works for them as their school's liaison officer. She speaks to students and other young people about young people who are going through homelessness. So you left school, and what happened after you left school,
Bea? Well, being as reckless as I am, I moved in with someone for a while, so I decided that I would move out of home. I was actually already living out of home by the time I dropped out of year 12, and then I met someone who is now my ex-boyfriend, and I lived with him for a while. He actually lived in Sydney, so I literally met him, and within 4 months I just packed up whatever I had and moved to Sydney to go and live with this person that I didn't know that well. And I mean, it wasn't like a particularly terrible relationship. Like, it was my first serious relationship, so I thought it was the best thing in the world. However, getting to that end point, it was not violent or physically abusive, but we both had a whole host of issues that we were bringing to the relationship. I'd say his upbringing was just as, sort of, there was neglect there was abuse there, all that sort of stuff. And what he was bringing to the table, that was the best he could offer. And, you know, all that stuff that was coming to surface, which it so often does when you become serious with someone, all this stuff from your past just comes right out. And that's what I did as well. And so it just took a whole bunch of stuff out on each other, really. And then it got to this point where I didn't want that anymore. And I ended up ending things with him, and he basically told me just to get out of the apartment that we were living in. On top of that, we'd also been traveling overseas for 7 months beforehand. he's just as reckless as I am. And we didn't really think that trip through. We went over in like the midst of the recession and couldn't get jobs over there. But...
So you racked up credit card debt?
Yeah, big credit card debt. So split between us, I think that I was 20 years old at the time and had 13 grand credit card debt, no job because I quit my job to go overseas because we felt it would just be so appropriate to escape, not thinking about what we'd have to come back to. Ended up breaking up. He ended up kicking me out. Fair enough, you know, I'm not just going to live there when we're apart. But then... as I walked out that door, I realised that I was over 13 grand in debt with no job and no family that I could go home to. So
this brings us full circle to this period of homelessness. Did you couch surf for a while? Did you ever spend a night in the streets? Did you ever get to that point where you had had no roof over your head?
No, I was actually exceptionally lucky that I was never a rough sleeper. So I was never in primary homelessness. I do recall in my childhood, so when I was in primary school, my mum and I actually spent a night in the bathrooms out, can't remember what it's called, but near Belconnen in Canberra. So we spent a night there because my mum had actually, that's a bit of a long story anyway, but back to this day, I was never a rough sleeper. I was a couch surfer, which is sort of, it's the middle stage of homelessness, and it's many young people end up in this situation, couch surfing, because they'll do anything to avoid being on the street, so they'll, you know, just stay with whoever they can find, really, just to avoid being a rough sleeper.
It is kind of amazing at this point, eventually, as you say, you got a job in a law firm while while living in a homeless shelter. That's incredible.
So
did they know? Did they suspect?
Well, okay, so, yeah, we're full circle back to Oasis now. And there was a time when... so basically I was working at the law firm. They did not suspect a thing. My residential address read like Elizabeth Street, Sydney, which is very, very expensive if you were actually living there. And so my boss was like, oh my goodness, like look at you. You must have saved a lot to be able to move out there. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is actually ridiculous. And then it was a massive women's refuge. They, you know, was so overrun with, I think there was like 50 rooms there, and they didn't really provide that personalised one-on-one support. So I actually got myself kicked out of the crisis refuge, and I was back to couch surfing. My work still had no idea. So I was leading a team of five, not sure which couch I'd sleep on that night or if I would have to be on the street or what would happen. Because, you know, you sort of, you know that you're pushing your friends to that point. You're putting strain on them when really, you should never do that to someone. And so I was so unsure, but my work never. And that's really largely thanks to Oasis. The reason why is because they offered me a life coach, which most people don't think, ooh, a crisis refuge offering someone a life coach. But Oasis actually offers over 26 programs of this kind of thing. And so I had this life coach who would come and meet me at my work every week for 10 weeks. And he was the one that really kept me going.
How did that work? Is it because you had someone to be accountable to? Is that what it is? Or someone did you want to come to him with good news? Is that what it was? Or her? Or whoever the life coach was?
Yeah, well, it's actually my boss again. So the guy that I'd first met walking through there, he's actually a life coach as well.
The Steve Irwin
Steve Irwin
right,
guy.
John
so
Harris, right.
It's through their Employment Pathways program. And so he basically would come and meet me, and he always showed up. He was never late. He was just there for me. And so he was offering me leadership advice for my team leader role, which was really well and good. I applied that to my job. But what I really took away from it was, oh my gosh, this guy is showing up and he wants to know how my day is. Are you kidding me? Like, why? What for? Like, I'm not paying him money to do that. I don't understand why this person's so there for me. And that really was the one thing that changed my whole life, that really spiraled me to just become who I am today. Because I was like, can you imagine if someone like John, you know, could be there for every kid that's either at risk of homelessness or, it just really, to me, blew me away that someone could be that dedicated to a young person that's not their own child.
When you talk to students these days in schools, mm-hmm. for on behalf of Oasis? And what do you want them to know? What do you really want them to understand once you finish talking to them?
Well, there's a couple of things. The first one is obviously what I've learned through my own experience from meeting so many people of Oasis that, you know, homelessness doesn't discriminate anyone. So that is my key message that I just want them to understand. And the reason why I want them to understand that is because I don't want them to look at homelessness like, oh, it's never going to come near me, so I don't have to worry about it. And it's not that I'm saying you could become homeless at any moment, but it's more that I'm saying we just need to become more aware and more compassionate and empathetic about our surroundings. The person next to you could become homeless, and a family member could become homeless. And the way, you know, the numbers of youth homelessness right now, which is 32,000 young people between 12 to 24 are homeless at the moment.
God, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, that's really, really frightening.
That's a horrible figure.
Yeah, and there's about 10,000 homeless people, homeless young people going to school at the moment. So they'd be in school right now in Australia, and that to me is mind-blowing. And students, I guess, like anything else that's important, need to be educated on how severe the issue is, or else it'll just keep getting worse. And so that's my key message. The other things that I want them to understand, which not just to do, they're very important for youth homelessness, but really apply to any aspect of life, is that we just need to, you know, maybe try and look at what's going on for someone underneath their surface behaviours. So if you'd met me when I was 16 or anyone, they would have been like, oh, like, you know, she's just not someone I want near my child. She's just not someone that I want around, you know, popping pills at 16. It's just, it's not right. You know, you can debate that. And, but I guess what I'm trying to say is I was hurting so, so much at the time that, you know, people feel really trapped in their situations. It's almost like this vicious cycle. You know that people are judging you, and so it makes you feel awful. It brings your self-esteem down, so you go and make those stupid decisions over and over again to try and escape from that. And it's like you just keep going because, yeah.
Bea, it's been such a pleasure meeting you, and a real fantastic thing to have you on this program
Thank
today.
You.
And amazing to hear your story, and that's going to create a lot of comment and thought. There's information about the Oasis Project and the work that Oasis does on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. Be great to meet you, and thank you so much for being my guest in conversation today.
Thank you.
Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.